This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You want a nice green world full of solar panels and wind machines? So do I, but as we're about to find out, that isn't going to be easy, if it's possible at all. Of course, trying to survive in a climate wrecked by fossil fuels may not be possible either. Richard Heinberg is our guest, and he's known around the world as an energy expert. He's a leader and senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. He's the author of 13 books and a returning guest on Radio EcoShock. So when I got his newest book, written with David Fridley from the Berkeley Lab, I expected a triumphant plan for our transition to renewable energy in that post-carbon world. I was a little surprised, and we're all in for big surprises about how hard this change is going to be. It's all in the new book, Our Renewable Future, Laying the Path for 100% Clean Energy. It was published in June 2016. Richard Heinberg, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
I suppose I shouldn't be shocked. Richard, you're known for taking a hard and doubtful look at things like oil reserves and coal industry hype. Now you're digging into the realities of renewables. First of all, who is your co-author and what does he contribute to this discussion?
Well, David Fridley is a staff scientist at the Energy Analysis Program at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories. In his job, he's worked primarily with the government of China to assess and help design their national energy plan. And a lot of that has to do with renewable power. He's recently worked with the government of China and Rocky Mountain Institute, specifically on energy efficiency and renewable energy. So he's, I would say David is the number one expert in the United States on Chinese energy and one of our top experts on energy planning and specifically as that relates to renewable power.
Well, that's good news that you got him on board to work with you. Now, as you discuss in your book, this whole green dreaming world felt empowered when Professor Mark Jacobson of Stanford wrote an article in Scientific American way back in 2009. Jacobson said we can make that switch to alternative energy by 2050, and I interviewed Mark in late 2014. He felt even more certain it's all possible. What's your take on the Jacobson plan?
Well, it is a transition to all renewable energy certainly is possible. We don't want to suggest that it isn't. However, it's not just a matter of building lots of solar panels and wind turbines, and Jacobson's plans mostly have to do with supply side. How do we supply enough renewable energy? What David Fridley and I did was look at the overall energy system, not just how we produce energy, but also how we use it. And that does present some daunting challenges, which Mark Jacobson mentions from time to time in his various proposals, but doesn't explore very deeply. Sometimes the devil is in the details, and we were looking at things like making cement. It doesn't sound like a very big thing, but cement is the main ingredient in concrete, which in turn is really the foundation of our physical civilization. Large buildings, highways, landing strips for aircraft, on. Without concrete, you know, it would be very difficult for us to construct and repair the world that we are used to inhabiting. Well, making cement is extremely energy intensive. It requires temperatures of about 1,500 degrees Celsius. And it would theoretically be possible to supply that kind of high heat with renewable energy, either with fuels made from renewable electricity, hydrogen, and other kinds of fuels, or directly with concentrated sunlight. It's possible to achieve those kinds of high temperatures with focused sunlight. But it's very likely that the process would be considerably more expensive, maybe 2-3 times as expensive as the current cement production process. And we have no demonstration projects. We don't even know how easy or difficult it would be or how expensive it would be because we're not even trying to do it that way. So this is a problem we ran into again and again with industrial processes and many transport modes. the substitutes, where they would be available, would likely not be drop-in substitutes. They would require research and development, and in many cases would probably be considerably more expensive than processes that we're currently using.
Well, you know, one of the questions I get all the time, Richard, is can we produce and then reproduce solar panels and wind machines without fossil fuels?
Well, that's another question. Currently, we are using fossil fuels to produce, as you say, solar panels and wind turbines. Theoretically, the process could be electrified, but we're talking about a process with many steps that starts with extraction of raw materials. Currently, the way we mine using giant mining machines that run mostly on diesel fuel, it's hard to imagine that being electrified. It's, you know, theoretically, it might be possible using electrical power produced on site and transmitted to these huge earth-moving machines via cables. Certainly, they're not going to be able to be run on batteries, but perhaps using cables, it might be possible. But again, you know, we weren't able to identify any pilot projects. And then that's just one step in the process of making wind turbines and solar panels. And you get all the way to the process of installation. With wind turbines, of course, there, we go right back to the question we talked about earlier, the need for concrete. Very large amounts of concrete are used in anchoring wind turbines in place. So, you know, from the materials through high-heat industrial processes all the way to delivery and installation, there are lots of challenges in producing, installing, transporting renewable energy devices using only renewable energy. And that's one of the reasons we brought up in our book the question of how are we going to use our remaining fossil fuels? Because we're going to install enough renewable energy capacity to forestall the worst of climate impacts, we're going to have to put up wind turbines and solar panels many times faster than we're currently doing it, at least 10 times faster, maybe 20 times as fast. And that will mean a lot of resource extraction, transportation, high-heat industrial processes that, at least in the early to mid phases, will have to be powered by fossil fuels. So aren't we going to have to do a kind of triage where we reduce our consumption of fossil fuels for all the other things we're doing, like, you know, flying to Las Vegas for the weekend, and deliberately devote our remaining fossil fuels to the energy transition?
Yeah, you know, it calls up so many different questions from that. It's hard to know where we can go. I mean, just another example, you talked about cement. Let's talk about plastic. Everything seems to be made out of plastic now when I go to the store. Can we make plastic at all without fossil fuels?
Well, yes. There are a number of plastics now being produced using corn and other biological materials. The problem is that most of those plastics, many of which are biodegradable and could be used in a lot of packaging. The problem is that we use plastics also for purposes where we need really high performance values in medical technology, in automobiles and aircraft and so on. We need plastics that are extremely durable, heat resistant, that will withstand impacts and so on. And so far, the kinds of bioplastics that are currently available don't meet those kinds of stringent performance requirements. So one of the roadblocks we came up against was specifically in the area of pharmaceuticals. We spoke with an expert in that area who is very sympathetic to the idea of the energy transition. But he was scratching his head and saying, well, you know, look, there aren't any good substitutes right off the bat for fossil fuels as feedstocks in making pharmaceuticals. So aren't we going to have to just, you know, reduce our use of fossil fuels for energy production and save them for things like this where, you know, we just don't have any good substitutes?
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, Richard Heinberg. We're talking about his new book, Our Renewable Energy Future. Well, we won't have time to go into everything, all the stuff you cover in the book. It's dizzying, the asphalt, the chemicals, the roads, the paint, it just goes on. But the hardest hurdle, I think, is getting fossil fuels out of agriculture. Richard Heinberg, would you care to tell our listeners some of the many places that oil, gas, and coal end up producing food for us?
Right. Well, it's not all just about diesel fuel for tractors. In fact, direct use in agriculture of fossil fuels is not the largest use of fossil fuels in our food system as a whole. It turns out that food processing is the biggest single area of energy use. And packaging is also very large. Transportation is another slice of the pie. And when you add them all together, we're using about 12 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce each calorie of food energy. So transitioning all these aspects of our food system is going to be a big job. We need to localize our food systems as much as realistically possible in order to reduce transport energy, reduce processing of food as much as possible. So we're buying foods that are less processed. Part of that processing occurs in the home, processing and storage of food in your refrigerator and on your stove. So having as efficient machines for this as possible is important, but also, you know, we have a lot of natural gas-powered stoves all across the country in people's homes, and one part of the energy transition is going to be just folks trading out their natural gas stoves for electric stoves, because we're going to have to electrify as much of our energy usage as possible in the transition. So you look at the food system as a whole, there are lots of moving parts, and we're going to have to electrify as much of it as possible. But I also want to mention the opportunity in agriculture, because up to this point, agriculture has been a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions, not only in the energy we use for all these purposes we've discussed, but also in the CO2 that's released from the soil as we degrade soil with ordinary industrial agricultural practices, tillage, application of pesticides, herbicides, and so on. We're basically killing the soil, and as the soil dies, it releases CO2 into the atmosphere. We have the opportunity to reverse that process. Lots of research has gone on in recent years in agroecology, whereby we develop and renew topsoil. We increase the biological activity of topsoil. And in doing so, we can actually capture and sequester very large amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. So by transitioning our food system, we could not only make it more amenable to renewable energy inputs and reduce energy consumption in that, also actually reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by very substantial amounts.
And, of course, this ties into the most unpopular problem of all, expanding human population. Can we sustain over 7 billion or more people without fossil fuels? And if not, are you suggesting strict social control of reproduction or a mass die-off or what?
Well, we did include a section in the book on population because we thought it was important to address the subject. It's going to be extremely difficult to supply the energy that the world currently is using from all renewable energy inputs. In fact, we think it's extremely unlikely that world energy will be able to remain at current levels or certainly to grow over future decades using only renewable energy inputs. So that raises the question of population. You know, if population is growing but energy isn't, that would mean on a per capita basis we'd have ever less energy to work with. And energy is really at the core of everything we do. So that's really a pretty stark future to imagine. But if population were declining, then all of the problems that we're talking about would suddenly become much easier to solve. If we can reduce energy per capita in a way that doesn't take away basic human requirements, that still meets basic human needs, and also reduce population, we could arrive at a situation where our energy needs are relatively easily met by renewable sources. The biggest problem that David Fridley and I identified in transitioning to the renewable future is the problem of scale. Just the vast scale of energy usage that humanity is accustomed to currently, much less what we would need if population grows and per capita usage continues to grow. That problem of scale dogs every challenge that we identified in the industrial sector and transportation and food everywhere. Scale is the biggest problem.
So, Richard, in your new book, you and David Fridley have a whole chapter on energy and justice. Why can't we just stick with solutions technology and leave all this lefty social engineering out of the plans?
Well, the reality is energy justice is already a huge issue in the world. If you look at a graph, which we reproduce in the book, of energy usage per capita and rich and poor, they align almost perfectly. If you have lots of energy available, you're able to do a lot more. So we have a world in which economic inequality is growing, and we're talking about making an enormous energy transition. How is that transition going to impact inequity? Well, it could, in fact, actually make matters worse, because it's going to cost a lot to transition to renewable energy. And if only the people with lots of money can afford to make that transition, then what we end up with at the end of the day is a few people with plenty of energy and everybody else with either dysfunctional energy systems or no energy systems to speak of. So the way we are going to get around that, I think, is with more not only distributed generation, but distributed ownership of generation. We will need cooperative and community-owned energy systems, and the only way to get there is to design from the get-go, design the process, the economic process as well as the physical process of making the energy transition, as one where ownership is in the hands of the people who use that energy.
And you have another chapter for all the issues people think you should have covered, the questions that always come up at public forums on energy transition. Let's just quickly tackle two of them. First, why don't you join James Hansen to call for more nuclear power as a way to avoid horrible climate change?
Well, the reason is we don't think that's a practical alternative. The only places in the world where nuclear power is growing are China and maybe a few other nations, India. But elsewhere, nuclear power is on the way out, and we think for good environmental and economic reasons. It's expensive and it's risky. And that's not just the judgment of environmentalists. Increasingly, it's the judgment of national governments, which have had to subsidize nuclear power for decades now. And those subsidies really haven't paid off. So we don't see nuclear power as a realistic alternative to renewables. So what we decided to do in our book is make it a thought exercise entirely around renewable energy. Yes, it's likely that in 20 or 40 years, there will still be a certain percentage of world energy coming from nuclear power. But for the purposes of our thought exercise, we excluded that.
And you do talk about changes at the consumer end, and I wonder, are people really willing to give up all their energy slaves and the freedom to fly to Las Vegas for the weekend, as you say? I mean, is that making America great again?
Well, in our view, there simply is no other way forward. We have an energy system currently that relies mostly on fossil fuels for about 85% of our energy. And that's simply an unsustainable energy system. And when I say unsustainable, I don't mean it's insufficiently eco-groovy. I mean that we can't keep doing this much longer. We're already seeing a global oil industry that's in the throes of near collapse simply because the best prospects are gone. All of our new oil production prospects are in really expensive areas like the tight oil in North Dakota and South Texas, the tar sands in Canada, deep water oil, Arctic oil, and so on. the good stuff is gone, and what's left is going to be very expensive to produce, and the economy just can't bear oil prices that high. A similar thing, everywhere you look in fossil fuel industries, natural gas, coal, it's not as though we're running out of these fuels, but we are running out of the cheaply, easily accessed fuels, and that means that as time goes on, it's going to become harder, more expensive, and more environmentally risky to continue relying on these fuels. So if we do that, if we don't deliberately make a transition to renewable energy, what we will see is, you know, we will be giving up those energy perks, the trips to Las Vegas and all the rest, but we'll be doing it with no alternative.
So I'm thinking of compiling a list, maybe 25 things we can do personally to help prevent catastrophic climate change. And what would be the top five items on that list as far as you're concerned?
I think one would be doing a personal energy audit, just looking at your own life to see how you're using energy, not just in electricity, because electricity is only about 20% of all the energy that we use. So looking at energy that you use in the food that you consume, in transportation, in packaging, in the stuff you buy, and see where you can make the most difference. Many people find that cutting out air travel is the single biggest thing they can do to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, just by doing that one thing, making a personal energy audit, you can basically fill out that list of the five biggest things.
Why did you write this book, Richard?
Well, you know, more and more people are talking now about the renewable energy transition, and we think that's a very good thing. But we felt that it was really important for the discussion to get beyond just how many solar panels and how many wind turbines do we need. Energy transitions in history, you know, the discovery of fire, the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, which really should be called the fossil fuel revolution. Energy transitions are overwhelming transformations of society that usually end up transforming not just food systems and transportation, but political systems, economic systems, how people think about the world, people's daily lives. We think we're on the cusp of something just as transformative now, but the conversation is still pretty one-dimensional. We wanted to start to add some dimensionality to that conversation so that the people can begin to prepare and think realistically about what's ahead. And hopefully policymakers can do the same.
Where do people go to find out more about your new book?
Well, the best place folks can go is ourrenewablefuture.org. We have a wonderful website for the book, which has the entire contents of the book, plus a lot of material that isn't in the physical printed book. Obviously, we're happy for people to buy the physical book, but we think this information is important enough that we want folks to have access to it, whether they can afford to buy the book or not. So go to the website, and you'll find everything you want.
We've been talking to one of the best guides to a post-carbon world, author and energy analyst Richard Heinberg. His latest of 13 books is just out this June 2016. It's called A Renewable Future, Laying the Path for 100% Clean Energy. I thought I might just skim through it, to be honest, but I ended up reading it cover to cover. It's that good. Richard, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. Basic life forms of the ocean are the source of most of the oxygen we breathe. Are they in deep trouble? Did you know plankton can affect the development of clouds? Another surprise in the climate story. We're talking about plankton and climate change with Dr. Michael Barenfeld. He's a senior research scientist and professor at Oregon State University. Mike specializes in marine algae research. Barenfeld is also the principal investigator for a special five-year NASA project called NAMES, with two A's, the North Atlantic Aerosols and Marine Ecosystems Study. Mike, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've kind of developed a grab bag of questions about plankton, and you're the guy, so let's take a shot at it and see how far we can get. For those new to plankton, maybe we should start with the most common misconception. People say to me, show me a plankton, like show me a tiger or something. What does plankton really mean?
Plankton, basically the word is derived from a term meaning free-floating. And there are two basic categories we think about most often in the plankton, although there's a couple more. We think about the zooplankton, which are the essentially zoo meaning animals. They're this very small animals that are free-floating in aquatic systems in the ocean and lakes. And there are phytoplankton, phyto meaning light. These are essentially the plants of the ocean. They're microscopic. There's also bacteria, plankton, and viruses. And these make up most of the plankton.
And then we talk about a plankton bloom. What is their normal state, and then what is a bloom?
Okay, a plankton bloom it's basically a high concentration of phytoplankton. And along with a high concentration of phytoplankton, you also have higher concentrations of the other plankton, the zooplankton, and the bacteria, and the viruses. It's a bit of a relative term. You know, we often might be driving along a road and go by a pond in the summertime, and the pond is green. We would say that, oh, that's a phytoplankton bloom. But more of the question is about basically the process of blooming. So the process of blooming means that the concentration of phytoplankton is going from a relatively low level to a higher level. And the largest phytoplankton bloom on the planet occurs in the North Atlantic. And that's where the NAMES study is focused.
Why would NASA be interested in plankton blooms in the North Atlantic Ocean?
Wow, great question. One of the hopes, of course, is that the bloom in the North Atlantic, if we can understand that bloom, it will tell us about blooms all over the world. Hopefully the fundamental processes are similar. NASA's interested in this because phytoplankton and the zooplankton and others that eat them are the base of marine food webs. They feed our fisheries. They interact with the atmosphere. Phytoplankton take up a lot of the nutrients that get dumped into the ocean from rivers. And they also take up CO2, carbon dioxide, from the atmosphere. And NASA has actually been studying phytoplankton from space for many years, which is kind of an interesting concept to think of, that you're looking from space at things that you can't even see with your eye, these tiny little phytoplankton. But what they do is when you have more and more phytoplankton in the water, it changes the color of the water, kind of like what I said just a minute ago. You're driving down the road, you see a pond, and it's green. Well, that's because the phytoplankton are selectively absorbing different colors of light, but not very good at absorbing the green light, which is why the pond turned green. So basically, that's what the satellite is doing. It's looking at the color of the ocean. And so what NASA is interested in is being able to study the phytoplankton globally using the satellite sensors and to understand better how the phytoplankton annual cycles develop, what drives them, how they're related to the environment, the physical environment, and ultimately inform us about how the health of these planktonic ecosystems is related to the climate of the planet.
So aside from the satellites, what other tools does the NAMES project use to track these tiny life forms?
Yes, that's a good question. We're actually using a lot of different tools. The NAMES project involves ship measurements. So we have over 30 scientists going out on ships, a ship, four times over the project, studying different parts of the annual cycle. When we're on the ship, we deploy what are called autonomous floats, and these are really great devices. They go up and down in the water column autonomously, and they measure plankton properties, and they can be out there for multiple years. So after the ship leaves, we have these floats that continue the measurements for multiple years, so we can follow what happens after we have left a certain area. And studied it intensely. And then coupled with the ship measurements and the float measurements, we also have an airplane. It's a NASA C-130 Hercules, and there's a number of scientists on the airplane that are doing measurements with remote sensing instruments as well as measurements of actual direct sampling of the air. And the remote sensing measurements are an ocean color sensor, very much like what we fly in space. There's a LIDAR on the aircraft, and the LIDAR is basically a pulsing laser, and it allows us to make measurements of properties in the atmosphere as a function of the height of those properties in the atmosphere, and it also looks into the ocean and can tell us about the structure of the plankton from the surface of the ocean down to depth. And then we also have a third remote sensing instrument on there that's a polarimeter, and what it's looking at is effects of atmospheric constituents on the polarization of sunlight, essentially. I think a lot of people are familiar with the idea of polarized light when they buy polarized sunglasses.
Okay, now could you, Mike Barenfeld, please explain for us how the plankton life cycle could affect the development of clouds?
Good question. Very interesting story. So a little bit about clouds. So clouds can't form on their own, I guess you could say, without the help of aerosols. So if you just have a lot of water vapor in the air, it won't necessarily form a cloud because that water vapor has to condense around a nucleus, okay? And that nucleus is a particle, a very small particle. We're talking about particles in the size range of, about 100 nanometers or so to about a micron. And the properties of the cloud are dependent upon the abundance of these nuclei, these particles, these aerosols. And in parts of the planet, the amount of aerosols that are in the troposphere actually limits the ability of the cloud to form. And over the open ocean, certain parts of the open ocean, the abundance of those aerosols is linked to properties of the plankton. So over the course of the annual cycle, phytoplankton do their photosynthesis and they grow, they get eaten by things, and then the waste products get processed by bacteria. And through the process of wind and wave action and bubble formation, bubble bursting at the surface, these little organic molecules get released to the atmosphere and lofted up in the boundary layer, and then they can start interacting with clouds and functioning as condensation nuclei for the water vapor.
So the million-dollar question for me is, would plankton-related clouds be important enough to change the Sun-Earth energy balance? That is, can this affect climate change?
Absolutely. So like I was saying, the properties of clouds are related to the amount of aerosols that you have. If you have very few aerosols, very few of these condensation nuclei, each one of those nuclei will collect a lot of water around it. So you form clouds with large droplets, and those tend to be darker clouds. If you have a lot of aerosols, then the droplets tend to be smaller. Those tend to be brighter clouds. So brighter clouds reflect more of the sunlight energy back into space. So the brighter the cloud, the more cooling effect it has on the climate.
Now, as you know, various countries have tried stimulating plankton blooms to study carbon capture, and then a citizen named Russ George worked with the Haida Nation off Canada's west coast. They dumped over a ton of iron into the ocean, and Russ George claims a plankton bloom did result. What are your thoughts, Mike, on such experiments?
I think that the original iron enrichment experiments that were conducted were focused on the basic scientific questions of what limits the stocks of phytoplankton in the ocean. They were not focused on so much a manipulation of ocean ecosystems for carbon sequestration. In fact, I was involved in one of the first of those. It was called IronX2, which took place in the equatorial Pacific. And some of the interest in that work was, if you have populations of phytoplankton that are limited by iron, their health, their basic physiology, is different than if they're limited by something else, light or nitrogen or phosphorus. And trying to understand what parts of the ocean are limited by iron versus other factors was a very important scientific quest. And it even has a role in our way of interpreting the satellite data. There's been a lot of heated discussions about the utility of this iron fertilization for carbon sequestration, a lot of meetings about it, and there's a lot of literature out there about pros and cons on doing such a thing. I think we always have to think about in such manipulations of natural ecosystems beyond just the immediate goal. So, you know, what are the impacts of causing a bloom? Well, you might have more phytoplankton biomass, which might take up more CO2, but what's the fate of that? What kind of phytoplankton are going to bloom? Can we even predict that? Are they going to be a harmful species? Are they going to be a beneficial species? What are the longer-term ramifications on the food web? And what happens after the initial bloom? So there's, you know, it's a complicated story, and unless we look at all of the nuances of the consequences of such manipulations, I think that they're probably not well advised.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Michael Barenfeld, a plankton specialist with Oregon State University and a NASA project called NAMES. In the previous Radio EcoShock show, I talked with scientists Peter Brewer and John Shepard about research into oxygen reduction in the oceans as the seas warm. Is that a real concern for plankton?
The oxygen reductions, I didn't listen to that radio show. I'm sure that Peter probably filled you in with lots of details on that. There are changes in oxygen minima zones in the ocean. They tend to be deeper than the sunlit photic zone where the phytoplankton are.
That's right. Actually, he did mention that it was further down that they're finding, you know, without enough oxygen.
Yeah. So what's happening, of course, is that you have photosynthesis going on in the surface by the phytoplankton, and then some of that organic carbon that they form is not recycled in the surface and is exported or sinks down to deeper depths, and then it gets utilized by other organisms that use up the oxygen while they're using up the carbon. And so that's why you get this separation between the photosynthesis at the surface and these deeper oxygen minima zones.
And, you know, I've read stories that global plankton are in decline, some say up to 40% loss. Where are we with that? Is global plankton in decline?
The best record that we have about the global state of the phytoplankton is satellite data. Satellites give us that true global view. It's really hard to make a global assessment with ships or just measurements from a dock or something like that. What we see in the satellite record so far, which started in 1978, and there was a gap until 97, and then from 97 to the present, we've had continuous measurements. What we see is that the variations, if you look at the globe as a whole, that variations in the phytoplankton currently are dominated by what appears to be natural variations in climate. So El Nino, La Nina transitions tend to have a very large global footprint. And we can see that and relate it to those kinds of climate fluctuations, oscillations in the Pacific and the Atlantic, et cetera. Teasing out an anthropogenic component of that is very complex. So I don't think that there is, from a globally integrated perspective, a definitive study showing or distinguishing the natural variability from the anthropogenic variability. Now, that being said, when you start looking at regional variations, the regional variations tend to be much stronger. And so that we do see trends not only in the abundance of phytoplankton, but also the organisms that are dominating during different times of the year. So when you start looking more regionally, the interannual changes tend to be larger, and they not only include changes in the total, they also include changes in the players.
And what about ocean temperature? I mean, some parts of the ocean, say around Australia or closer to your study area in New England, have been abnormally hot in recent years. What effect does that have on plankton?
It's a complex question, actually. The answer to it is complex, I'm sorry. So temperature has both direct and indirect effects on plankton. There are direct metabolic effects on plankton, but there are also indirect effects. And what I mean by that is that if you warm the surface of the ocean, that influences the ability of nutrients deeper depths to get into the surface area where the phytoplankton are growing. It also influences how much light the surface phytoplankton see. And so the indirect effects on the nutrient supply and the light supply that the phytoplankton experience is probably, or is almost certainly, the greater consequence of the temperature changes. And so we see this very clearly in the satellite data, that we can look at the relationship between phytoplankton abundance and sea surface temperature. And when we look at the changes in those two properties, we see that we generally have a reduction in the photosynthetic pigments that the phytoplankton have when temperatures warm, and when temperatures cool, those pigments go up. And that pigment response is a reflection of nutrient availability and how much light the cells are seeing. So to be a little more specific, when a phytoplankton, holding all other things constant, when a phytoplankton sees more nutrients, it gets greener because it's growing faster. It needs to collect more light, just like a plant in your house would. If they see more light for a given amount of nutrients, they get less green, okay, because they need less pigment to absorb the energy that they need from the sun if there's more sunlight. Okay, so you have a trade-off between these two things. So what we see from the satellite clearly is that when there's warming of the surface ocean, the pigment goes down, And that pigment signal is both an effect of nutrients and effect of light.
I think another NASA press release suggested that plankton will thrive closer to the poles as the globe warms and perhaps dwindle around the tropics. Would you agree with that?
Again, that comes back to the basic question of the limitations of light and nutrients. And so I think that probably what was being suggested there is that toward the tropics, the phytoplankton tend to be persistently limited by nutrients. And if you warm the surface, it just makes it harder and harder for nutrients to get to the surface. In the higher latitudes, for large portions of the year, nutrients are pretty high in their concentrations, and light is the limiting thing. So if you're warming those waters, it's possible that the phytoplankton near the surface are actually experiencing more light, so they would have a faster division rate. Now, one of the other things that we always should keep in mind when thinking about these blooms or these abundances of phytoplankton is that the abundance of phytoplankton is not just dependent upon how fast the phytoplankton are growing. It's also dependent upon how fast they're being eaten. So it truly is an ecology problem. And the way I like to explain this to people sometimes is if you look at your lawn, you can't tell how fast the lawn is growing by how tall your grass is, right? Because it depends on how fast it's growing and how often you're mowing it. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay, so the same thing with the phytoplankton. When you're looking at the stalks of the phytoplankton, it's the net effect that you're looking at between how fast the phytoplankton are growing and how quickly they're being eaten. And so it always is an ecological problem, not just a problem of light and nutrients.
It is really mind-blowing, Mike, to look at photos from space satellites at those blooms. They look like artwork and almost the size of European countries. How big do they get and how fast can they develop?
Wow, great question as well. So how big can they get? The North Atlantic bloom, as I mentioned before, is the largest bloom over spatially anywhere on the planet. And it starts from about New England, 45 degrees latitude-ish, New England, England, and goes up to the pole. And the bloom reaches its peak in early May to June, July, and it goes, the peak is earlier to the south, and it's delayed as you go further to the north, of course, following light and temperature changes. Is that what you wanted to know?
Yes. I also wanted to know sort of how fast that can happen. I mean, are we talking weeks or months?
Yeah. So this is actually a very interesting question, and it's one of the driving science questions for the NAMES project. So the traditional view of the North Atlantic bloom was that the bloom started in the spring, and it was kind of like the greening of trees on land, right? So if you live in a deciduous forest, we know that every spring, in the wintertime, the landscape is brown, and in the spring, all of a sudden, the trees start throwing these leaves. Why is that? Well, the reason for that is that the trees are monitoring the temperature and light conditions, and when they get the right cues, it says, okay, it's time for us to start throwing leaves. So in other words, it's driven by light and temperature. And then you get the full leaving in the summer. And traditionally, we've thought that, well, that's probably what's going on in the ocean, that you have some critical light and temperature condition, and that's when the bloom starts. Well, interestingly, once we started having satellites that could look at this ocean all the time, in other words, all year long, normally we send our ships out when the conditions are better. But with a satellite, it doesn't get seasick, so, it can actually watch what happens in the winter. And what we've recently discovered is that, in fact, the blooming period in the North Atlantic starts in the winter. And it comes to an end when the division rate, the growth conditions, are at their peak. Okay? And that's kind of strange. It's like saying that trees start throwing their leaves in winter, and they drop their leaves when they get to the best time in early summer. And so one of the questions we have is, well, what could possibly drive that? Why would we see that in the North Atlantic? And why is it so different than on the terrestrial system? So getting back to your question, what that means is that the blooming phase of the plankton annual cycle in the North Atlantic starts in December-ish, and it lasts until June. So it lasts for many, many months. So that's kind of the speed of this. Now, over the course of that period, you have periods where they start declining again, and then they come up again. So it's not just this constant blooming. It's going up and down and up and down, and that's tied to the physical environment, light and storms and things like that. So you can have short-term bursts which only last for a few days, for a few weeks. But the whole blooming event takes place over the course of many, many months.
And I've heard hints from scientists that warming could favor bacteria that actually eat plankton or destroy plankton. Can this balance be kept, or is it possible that something terrible could happen to the plankton?
Well, that's a big question. So as I mentioned when we first started talking, you know, one of our hopes with this project is to better understand this control, this annual cycle of the plankton bloom. And understanding that is not just about how fast they're growing, as I mentioned before, because there's also the things that kill them. You have zooplankton, viruses, and bacteria. And so understanding how that link, this basically it's a question of predator-prey relationships. How is that intimate food web of the plankton tied to the environmental conditions? Why do we get a bloom every year in the North Atlantic? And why is it different some years? Why is it lower one year and higher in another? Trying to understand that is really a core of this project. And that comes down to fundamental questions of losses of the phytoplankton to the bacteria you're talking about, but also to the grazers and to the viruses.
As a last sort of question, I'm going to open it up to you to say anything you like in just a minute. But before that, supposing in a coming decade the international community recognizes that plankton are in serious trouble, is there anything we could do about it, or is this a massive system well beyond any human intervention?
It is definitely a massive system. So can we do anything about it? If we find that, you know, that there's a clear signature or a clear effect of climate warming on the plankton of the globe, what would be necessary is to try and slow that climate trend down in order to hopefully reverse or stop whatever trend it is that we're trying to stop, which would take a very enormous cooperative effort to do. Is there a simple fix to the problem? No, I don't think there is a simple fix to the problem. We can't just go out and seed it with something. So it's a very complex system, and if trends start happening, we have to understand, first of all, why they're happening. And I'm not sure how well we could react in a manner that would stop some trend in global plankton communities.
Right. That's kind of what I suspected. As we wrap up here, Mike Barenfeld, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
Yeah, so there's one thing I thought I would mention. This is kind of an interesting anecdote. So a while back, if you had asked me, you know, what is the influence of phytoplankton on clouds, I would have been skeptical if there was one. And then I started learning about the research that was being done about this influence of ocean biology on atmospheric aerosols. And these are aerosols that are in what we call the lower boundary layer of the troposphere. That's from the surface of the ocean up to about where the base of clouds are. Okay, this is a well-mixed area. And as it turns out, there are certain parts of the global oceans where the amount of aerosols in the atmosphere is low enough that it can actually limit cloud formation. And so you might ask me, well, where are those places and why are those places? Those places are found particularly at higher latitudes and in truly open ocean areas. And what I mean by that is places in the ocean that are far away from land. So land gives off a lot of aerosols, and some of those aerosols are carried out over the ocean. But in this boundary layer, which is so important for cloud formation, this boundary layer, the lifetime of those aerosols from land is very short. It's on the order of a couple of days. And so as you get away from land, in particularly where there's common storms, rainstorms, because rain removes this from the atmosphere can become extremely clean. In other words, there's very, very low aerosols. And one of the interesting things that we did on the first NAMES cruise, which was in November of this last year, is we took a cup of coffee outside. Okay, so this is November, south of Greenland. It's cold, right? We take a cup of hot coffee out there, and guess what comes off the top of the coffee mug?
Steam?
That's what you'd expect, but there was no steam. Why is that? It's really interesting, right? You actually can go out in this freezing cold air, and you're not getting steam off of your cup. There's water vapor coming out of your cup of coffee, but there's no steam because there's so few aerosols, the steam can't form. Steam is the formation of water droplets. It's water condensing around particles. And if you take that cup of coffee and then you put a cigarette lighter up next to it and you flick the cigarette lighter provides a few aerosols and you get a puff of steam. And it was kind of one of those moments for me scientifically where I was like, oh, I get it, right? Yes, I can see how this part of the ocean can actually be significantly influenced by the biology. There's so few aerosols up there that, you know, even though the load of aerosols coming from the ocean plankton may be small, it's a big source for that part. And yeah, you can see that, oh, this is important. This could really make a difference. And if we see changes in the plankton over time, for whatever reason, that source of aerosols to that atmosphere is going to change. And that is going to change the clouds. And that, of course, then feeds back on the climate. As we talked about, you know, the more aerosols you have, the brighter the clouds, the more they reflect, the more they cool. So it was just kind of one of those really cool, tangible examples of like, oh, yeah, I really get it. This is important.
I love that story. From Oregon State University, we've been talking with Dr. Michael Barenfeld. He is the lead scientist in a project by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to study plankton blooms in the North Atlantic. That's the North Atlantic Aerosols and Marine Ecosystem Study, with the acronym NAMES. Find it at names.larc.nasa.gov. Or if you missed that, get links for everything in this interview in my show blog at ecoshog.info. Mike, thank you so much for your work and for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That seems like a good place to leave it for now. Somewhere out in the ocean, there is still air so pure, human-driven dust cannot be found. According to Michael Barenfeld, who is an acknowledged expert on satellite records of plankton, there is no evidence these essential ocean creatures are being killed off by climate change. That does run against headlines published in the Independent newspaper on July 28, 2010, titled "The Dead Sea: Global Warming Blamed for 40% Decline in the Ocean's Phytoplankton." That frightening article was based on a study published July 2010 in the journal Nature by Daniel G. Boyce and al. It's called "Global Phytoplankton Decline Over the Past Century." However, there has been a reevaluation in reading satellite data on plankton. Based on the point made by Mike Barenfeld in this interview, scientists have found that when conditions warrant, phytoplankton have less color and may be harder to see. In September 2015, NASA released a study showing diatoms, the largest phytoplankton algae, have declined by more than 1% globally every year from 1998 to 2012. Most of this decline was in the Northern Hemisphere, especially in the Northern Pacific Ocean. But Dr. Barenfeld did tell us that regional declines have been found, even though there is no published evidence, yet, supporting a global decline of all plankton. The balance of types of plankton may also be changing. It's complicated. Remember, in my show posted January 20th, 2016, Russian-trained plankton modeler Sergei Petrovsky said we don't yet know whether plankton will thrive or die off as the oceans warm. That's still a topic of scientific study and debate. But Petrovsky also said his models show that in either case, thrive or decline, plankton reaches a crisis point in warming where a massive die-off can occur. I'll put a link to that show in my blog at ecoshock.info. But for now, I'm going with this picture of an ocean which is struggling but far from dead. That's an important part of Radio EcoShock. We have plenty to worry about. There's no doubt about our future prospects that are cloudy, if not dire. I've had dozens of scientists on the show already this year who explain why. That said, there is a tendency in the public to expect, almost hope for, the worst, and soon. Some of us are tired of the strain. We want to see the end times before our lives end. It's been that way for thousands of years, at least for Christians, who may die disappointed they didn't see the terrible battles and Christ returning. Other thoughtful people realize our civilization is a heat engine, as the Utah scientist Tim Garrett told Radio EcoShock listeners a few years ago. We eat up ancient forests, don't we, for throwaway products? We dig up radioactive rocks and make them even more concentrated and poisonous. We burn fossil fuels for entertainment. We hunt and kill rare animals and plants for fun. We can't go on as we are and still leave a working ecosystem for our descendants, that's plain. There are serious scientists who will tell you, off and off the air, that only a severe economic crash can avert a mass extinction event. All the financial signs are flashing that collapse is coming. But then, the machine so far has kept running somehow. Most of us want it to keep going. After 45 straight shows peering into the dark future, I'm more than ready for my annual vacation. It's summer in the Northern Hemisphere. It will be a working vacation for me, as I harvest our large garden and put away lots of good food for the coming winter. That's how I stay sane, if I do, and that's part of the reason I can afford to donate my time for the science and activism that is Radio EcoShock. For the next few weeks, I'll be broadcasting shows from the large archive of past interviews. I'll be picking from programs that were downloaded thousands of times by listeners, some of them tens of thousands of times. There are voices which are either reflecting our minds or challenge them deeply. Our Radio EcoShock podcast is back, by the way. You can find the show on iTunes or any other podcatcher. Find the clickable podcast icons in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Feel free to browse all our past programs, to load up your iPod, computer, or MP3 player for summer listening with our free shows, or winter in the Southern Hemisphere. People in 91 countries listen to Radio EcoShock by podcast on our SoundCloud page or directly from the website at ecoshock.org. Of course, the podcast and blog only come out after the broadcast by our 94 participating nonprofit radio stations. That's the backbone of the show, and by far our largest audience. It's in the United States, Canada, the UK, and Australia so far. I deeply appreciate the volunteers and staff who make this radio station work, mostly advertising-free, well out of the corporate lens. Frankly, at this point, only non-corporate media seems willing to risk talking about the whole truth of climate change, our energy predicament, and the peril to all creatures. Which leads me back to two last things for now. As I said, despite the real scientific warnings, we have to be wary of apocalyptic messages that are not based on evidence. Second, as Richard Heinberg reminds us, there may be a way to safety with renewable energy, but it's not going to be easy. The changes each of us need to make are fundamental and difficult. We have to do a little better with nature every day and a lot better every year. Meanwhile, I'll be watching the world news and checking new science. I may toss a new tune on SoundCloud or blast out a short YouTube video. You'll get notice of that from my Twitter feed. Sign up at EcoShock. If anything extreme blows up or something just can't wait, I may have to do a new show or two. I hope not. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to learn, along with you, from some of the best minds of our generation. I'll be back with more original interviews at the start of September. Until then, please stay tuned as the best of Radio EcoShock comes your way every week.